You're listening to Clinical Conversations, formerly known as Admitting Diagnosis, the Journal Watch podcast for March 27th. I'm Joe Elia. You can get in touch with us by calling 1-617-440-4374 and leaving your reactions. We do appreciate that. We'll take a quick look at this week's news and then launch into an interview. This week we talk with Dr. Michael Carney about his JAMA article, the last in the series on end-of-life care, and it's about physician self-care. The news first. This week saw a lot of activity around the question, how valuable is tight glucose control during intensive care? First of all, the New England Journal of Medicine published the results of the amusingly named NICE Sugar Trial, in which 6,000 critically ill patients were randomized to either tight control, that is, glucose kept between 80 and 110 milligrams per deciliter, or conventional control, which was between 140 and 180. There were more deaths by the 90-day mark in the tight control group. Then, a Canadian group incorporated the NICE sugar results into its meta-analysis published in CMAJ. The Canadians found a survival benefit among surgical ICU patients on tight control, but asked that the American Diabetes Association and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists reconsider their recommendations for tight control in all critically ill patients. The associations, for their part, issued a statement urging against complacency in the face of uncontrolled hyperglycemia. Stay tuned. Next, there are some newly revised guidelines on heart failure issued jointly by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. The guidelines are wide-ranging, and they're available free on the Circulation website. Among the changes, there's a greater emphasis on the role of natriuretic peptides in stratifying risk. They recommend the use of hydralazine and nitrates in combination for African Americans on optimal therapy, but still having moderate to severe symptoms. Check them out. Finally this week, women who stop smoking early enough in pregnancy can substantially lower the risk of smoking-related complications, namely preterm births and small for gestational age infants. They've got to stop by week 16. Now, on to the interview. JAMA, in its March 18th issue, offers the last installment in its long-running series on care at the close of life. The title of the closing article is Self-Care of Physicians Caring for Patients at the End of Life. The piece starts out with a narrative about a busy hematologist-oncologist and uses that as the basis to explore two issues, clinician burnout and compassion fatigue. Burnout, according to the article, stems from the clinician's interaction with a stressful work environment, which could include, say, arguing with insurance companies. And compassion fatigue is like post-traumatic stress disorder, but it afflicts those witnessing the trauma of others, in this case, patients at the end of their lives. The article offers both advice about avoiding these risks and a look at the relevant literature. I thought you'd like to hear about this, so I invited the article's first author, Dr. Michael K. Carney, to discuss the piece briefly. Dr. Carney is an internist with the Palliative Care Service at Santa Barbara Cottage Hospital in California. He is the author of Mortally Wounded, Stories of Soul Pain, Death, and Healing, and also A Place of Healing, both published by Spring Journal Books. Welcome, Dr. Carney.
Thank you.
How long have you been involved in palliative care?
Well, I've been working in palliative care effectively all my professional life, which is a little over 30 years. I did an internal medicine residency in Ireland where I trained, and then from there I went and worked at St. Christopher's Hospice in London, where I worked on and off for 10 years and really got my specialist training in palliative medicine, which became a medical specialty in the United Kingdom during that period of time. So I've been in the field since then.
Was your work as an internist, was there a turning point in your decision to go into that field?
As I say, in my case, I actually decided as a medical student that this is what I wanted to do. I was a little uncertain which direction to go with my medical career. Somebody mentioned this place in London called St. Christopher's Hospice, and I went and did a 1-week training there as a final year medical student. and might sound unusual at that stage in one's career, but I actually really fell in love with the work at that point and decided that's what I wanted to do, and was advised that I'd need to come in either from internal medicine, doing a residency in internal medicine, or in family practice. I decided to do internal medicine. So, you know, and I haven't regretted that at all. I've been very, very happy working in this field.
The article has a vignette about a busy clinician who has to say goodbye to a dying patient, and yet he has to leave time to see the other 20 or so patients on the schedule that day. That must be an occupational hazard of end-of-life care.
It is an occupational hazard of end-of-life care, particularly for oncologists, medical oncologists, surgical oncologists, radiation oncologists, and indeed those working in geriatrics and internal medicine, who are doing end-of-life care as part of everything else they're doing. For specialists like me, who are now, you know, working in a dedicated way in palliative medicine, we have the relative luxury of having all our time dedicated to this aspect of care. But if one is combining it with a caseload of otherwise challenging patients waiting to be seen as outpatients or indeed on the floor, it adds an additional stressor to the work, for sure. And that's reflected in the literature, which shows, in fact, that the instance of burnout is higher in oncologists than it is in palliative care specialists.
Why is that?
Well, I think there are probably a number of reasons for that, not least that oncologists will have known their patients for longer than palliative care docs in most instances, will have seen them through many twists and turns in their illness, including perhaps having to change from treatment aimed at potential cure to treatment aimed at improving quality of life, and just having to manage that very difficult transition for the patient and the patient's family can be extremely stressful, I think, on the oncologist. And for the most part, those of us working in the field, in palliative care, palliative medicine, as specialists, that transition point has already been lived through. And so we're not having to negotiate that one. We're having to deal with a lot of other stressful situations, but not that particular one.
So you
I think in addition to that, oncologists, just their workload can be enormous. And you may remember from the article that when Dr. C, who is the oncologist who is telling his story, or whose story is used as a backdrop in the paper, he says, you know, what burns me out is not all the losses around my patients. What burns me out is arguing with insurance companies.
Yeah.
And I think oncologists have more of that to do than those of us working in a dedicated way in end-of-life care. We have our share of administrative hassles, too. But I think maybe the oncologists have more of that. So I think those are some of the reasons.
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Carney, if you talk a little bit about the difference between burnout, which is something familiar to most people, and compassion fatigue, which is something that I personally hadn't encountered before.
There are really interesting differences, and one of the key differences is in the genesis of the two different syndromes. That burnout is results from the stresses, accumulated stresses, between the individual physician and their work environment.
I see.
So things like excessive workload, a sense maybe of not being supported by the institution in which one works, a lot of those administrative sort of hassles, those are the sort of factors that lead to burnout over time. And burnout is experienced as ultimately is decreased work performance, but associated with extreme emotional and physical exhaustion. So there's the emotional exhaustion, there's often depersonalization or detachment in one's work, and a sense of low personal accomplishment. So there's a difference in the genesis, and there's also some difference in the actual shape of the presentation of the syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to that, compassion fatigue is what results from the interaction of the physician with the patient. That, that encounter can generate stress. That stress can lead to compassion fatigue. More specifically, it's described as resulting from the interaction between the clinician and the patient's suffering. And Figley, among others, has described compassion fatigue as a manifestation of secondary traumatic stress disorder. In other words, by being close to a patient who is experiencing extreme suffering and who is traumatized by their experiences, either of illness or sometimes indeed the treatment of illness, that the clinician who is close to that patient, particularly in an empathic way, is open to being secondarily traumatized, experiencing then, as a result of that, some of the symptoms that are seen with post-traumatic stress disorder, such as avoidance, you know, not wanting to go there again, such as hypervigilance, just kind of running on a low fuse, and so on. And so some of those symptoms of post-traumatic stress can manifest in the clinician who experiences compassion fatigue.
And you offer several suggestions in the article to help avoid compassion fatigue. A principle among them, I think, is a development of greater self-awareness. And there are several techniques that you recommend to do that, one of which is reflective writing. Do you have techniques that you personally use that you find most productive?
Yes, I do. And I'd like to say a little more about kind of the general as well as the specific, if I may. I practice,
sure.
I do practice reflective writing. I do practice mindfulness meditation, as it happens, which are two methods which we highlight. And we highlight them because they are both have a really substantial empiric base to support their effectiveness. But a point I'd like to go back to is just to remember again the genesis of compassion fatigue is in the empathic connection with the patient. And according to the kind of classical teaching around this, empathy is kind of seen in two ways. It's a positive connection with the patient, and the patient benefits from a physician who is empathic towards them. But what Figley and his colleagues have pointed out is that very empathic connection makes the clinician vulnerable to being traumatized by the patient's suffering. So, in other words, we need to be kind of careful around empathy. And the classic teaching around self-care in the face of compassion fatigue is the importance of having really good professional boundaries, for example, and having a good program of self-care in place for when one leaves work, so that when one goes home, one exercises, one has some maybe creative activity, one spends time in nature, you know, whatever replenishes and restores one, one has a good program of that to come back to, so to speak.
Yes.
And at work, that you maintain a certain objectivity and a certain clinical distance, because if you're too vulnerable, you are likely to be traumatized. Now, what we focus on in the article is the possibility, while acknowledging the value, the very real value of those self-protective mechanisms, and they're essential just for a sustainable work practice, but we highlight some interesting research that is really, I think, asking us to look again at the practice of empathy. This is work done by Harrison and his colleague Wellwood. Indeed, Harrison is one of the co-authors of this article. And in their work, they interviewed trauma therapists, psychotherapists who are working with patients who experience trauma, who have been doing this for many years and who are actually thriving in their work. Rather than experiencing compassion fatigue, they're thriving. And so they did a qualitative study and analyzed the data that they got from this to see if there were some common strands to how they did this. And they identify a number of practices, but one of these is the practice of what they call exquisite empathy. And in contrast to empathy through which the clinician can be traumatized, which is the sort of current dominant view of empathy, it's great, but be careful. You know, you need to maintain your boundaries and and look after yourself when you leave work. And, yes. And okay, so while acknowledging the value of that, what Harrison is suggesting is that if the clinician has developed self-awareness, the practice of self-awareness, and if that's combined with, yes, a good sense of one's professional boundaries, then it is possible to be in the empathic relationship in a very human, heartfelt way, but without the same likelihood of being overwhelmed by the patient's suffering. So that's why we focus in the final part of the article on the idea of developing clinician self-awareness. And we define this as a combination of self-knowledge and also the development of what's described as dual awareness, which is a sort of a cognitive skill, really, of expanded self-awareness, so that you can be in a clinical situation, you can be aware of the patient and the patient suffering, but you can simultaneously be aware and monitoring your own reactions in that situation.
Oh,
and that allows the possibility of a closer interaction, so the patient benefits from that, but it also allows for the possibility of kind of recognizing as it's happening when one is getting overstressed, when one is close to the edge, when one needs to maybe take a step back.
And you recommend some very simple techniques, like taking a break and a mid-afternoon break, setting your timer so that you take advantage of an off moment, or at least mindfully washing your hands or other things.
Well, that's right. We recognize that busy clinicians reading this might say, well, that's all very well for, you know, that's great work if you can get it, sort of thing. But, you know, where am I going to have time to practice mindfulness meditation or reflective writing? You know, I work in the real world, sort of thing.
Yes.
And so to sort of counter that criticism, or at least to acknowledge, I mean, it's a valid criticism, to kind of say, well, you know, is this doable for clinicians who are busy, who are in the workplace, who are on the coalface? We talk to a number of colleagues, many of whom have been in this work for many, many years, some up to 30 years and more. And, it was just a sort of a straw poll, but we collected their responses and put them in one of the boxes in the article. And as you say, these are very simple measures that are built into the everyday work practice, using things we're already doing, like the physical exam. But using it in a more mindful way, it can actually become a self-care practice as well as good clinical practice. And so that's why one of the metaphors we have in the article is that practicing self-care in a self-aware sort of way is like learning to breathe underwater.
Huh.
Because that image is meant to suggest that, normally, we're overwhelmed at work, we feel like we're drowning, the only possibility of getting air is really coming to the surface. And the parallel of that metaphor in real life is having good professional boundaries. We don't breathe underwater, and then we leave work and we come up for air and we have good self-care outside work. But the suggestion is that if we develop self-awareness and we bring that with us into the workplace, that actually some of the situations we encounter in the workplace can actually be regenerative, can actually be restorative. And in that sense, it's a bit like finding oxygen underwater, hence the breathing underwater image.
You offer at the end of the article some web resources for physicians, and I will put some of those onto the website with the podcast. And I should also mention, Dr. Carney, that you will be in JAMA's Author in the Room series, and that's going to take place. It's a teleconference.
That's right. And that's taking place on April 15th.
April 15th, between 2 and 3 Eastern Time. And so
All the details on how to sign on for that are in JAMA.
Are at the JAMA website. It's unfortunate that it's on tax day.
Oh, there you go. Maybe it'll do something to mitigate some of the stress.
That's right. Let's hope. Is there something that you would say to young physicians that from your experience, Dr. Carney, would you say you must avoid doing this most of all, or you must try to?
The first thing I would say is that what I learned from researching around this article is that just because one is a young physician does not mean that one is immune to not just stress in the workplace, but burnout and compassion fatigue. Indeed, a lot of the data suggests that burnout is more common in younger and less experienced physicians. So this is not just an issue. The issue of self-care is not just something one needs to worry about when you kind of reach midlife or mid-career or whatever. It is really something that should be built into one's awareness, I think, from the outset of one's career. And I think my advice would be to kind of really consider this idea of finding some way of developing a practice of self-awareness, not just as a self-care practice, but also as something that will make you a more sensitive and effective clinician. So I think that is what, and I don't think we can be any more prescriptive than that. I think everybody will have their own way of developing self-awareness and finding ways of practicing self-care that work for them. It's highly individual, and everybody's got to find their way. But I think my counsel would be to do that from the outset of one's career, not to think you're immune. You know, you have some sort of honeymoon period from burnout for the first 10 years as a physician. I'm afraid it appears that the contrary is true. Here's an instance where preventive medicine really is good medicine, not just for the clinician, but actually for one's patients as well.
Well, that's good advice, Dr. Carney. Thank you again for your time today.
Very welcome, Joe. Thank you.
We're all ears here at 1-617-440-4374. Give us a ring, please. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Isidore Yano. And I'm Joe Ilya. Enough said. We'll see you next week.